How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're discussing climate change and clean energy in the traditional news media. In the 2008 presidential campaign, John McCain and Barack Obama supported a cap-and-trade program for reducing carbon pollution. But in this year's election, candidates barely mention the climate, which has become a dirty word. Media coverage of climate concerns is down, though surging gasoline prices are prompting stories about fossil fuels, renewable energy, and more efficient cars. In California, the state is marching ahead with its own cap-and-trade program and efforts to promote solar, wind, and other forms of clean electricity. For the next hour, we'll look behind the headlines of America's energy debate with our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We're pleased to be joined by two veteran reporters, Felicity Beringer of the New York Times, environment reporter in San Francisco, and Mark Lifshire, a business reporter in Sacramento with the Los Angeles Times. Please welcome them to Climate One. Did I say that right, Beringer?
You did. You said it absolutely right, which is congratulations. That's rare.
Should have checked. Felicity, let's begin with you. Let's set the national context for energy, sort of the narrative that's happening right now in a presidential election year. Climate's not what it used to be, but what's the overarching narrative right now in energy and climate nationally?
Well, I think if you compare it to 2008, you've got two fairly big differences. And, of course, we're early in the election cycle yet. We haven't really seen the two parties actually, the two candidates
Early, it seems like it's been going on for so long, but yes, okay.
I know, but if you compare it to 2008, the two things that were striking in 2008, as you mentioned, were the both candidates talking about cap and trade in a very positive way, and talking about climate, particularly President Obama at the time, and also the drill, baby, drill mantra, which we forget. So now you fast forward to 2012, as you say, climate is present by its absence from virtually all discussions, except perhaps in Texas where they talk about drought, not climate, but drought. And in other parts of the West, too. And instead of drill, baby, drill, you have two auxiliary issues at the fore. One is the Keystone Pipeline, and the other is the question of possible environmental harm from fracking or hydraulic fracturing to get natural gas out of the ground. So this is a kind of atomization of the energy discussion, and I'd be interested to hear what Mark has to say as to where it might go from here.
Mark, you want to take that? Sure.
I think what you have is an absence of the environmental issue from the national debate, other than the kind of a quasi-religious thing that's going on, where Santorum says that who are we to, you know, God gave the earth to us and we should do whatever we want with it. Other than the he said, she said that's going on nationally, what you see in California is doing what it's done ever since the 60s, which is basically go its own way. California, for good or for ill sometimes, has always been ahead of the rest of the country and set the pace for the rest of the country. And you had that with the air pollution laws early on. L.A. was and is about the most polluted city in the country. And water pollution laws. And California was a pioneer in energy efficiency standards, started out in the first Jerry Brown administration. And since then, it saved a lot of electricity by just being more efficient without needing more fuel of any type. And California is, with the dearth of any action nationally, California is still carrying that flame. And you see it in, they just passed standards for power supplies for mobile products, phones and TVs and whatnot. And They keep irritating the National Manufacturing and the Electronics Association, but they can't do much about it because it's such a big part of the market.
And done that with other things like TVs and refrigerators before that. Let's pick up on the sort of the two side issues or the atomization that Felicity Beringer mentioned, Keystone XL and fracking, and talk about how those are playing into the debate. First, let's talk about Keystone. I don't think the first leg of this pipeline was built a few years ago with not much fuss, and now it's become this huge political issue.
Well, again, I think it's a way for particularly the environmental movement to focus on an indirect consequence of climate. They are saying, on the one hand, it's a siting issue, as they say in the business. Mm-hmm. This is jargon for where are you going to put something that might be deemed obnoxious. Siting pipes has not really been an issue hardly ever in America. Now, there are some questions as to whether due diligence was done, whether there was enough community buy-in along the route. But I think the bottom line argument that is giving energy to this discussion is we're taking a fossil fuel out of the ground and pushing it hundreds of miles to the southern coast of the United States, and we shouldn't be taking we shouldn't be using fossil fuels. Now, there's an alternative argument, of course, which is we can't stop using all fossil fuels today without the economies of the world collapsing. We've had enough trouble with the close call on a collapse back in 2008. So nobody's really eager for that. So what are we going to do to take the world and the United States and California from where they are today in terms of use of fossil fuels and move them to a place where fossil fuels are very much less important?
But that oil is going to come out of the ground, and it's going to be upgraded from a heavy crude to a nice sweet crude. And the pipeline's just going to go west, and it's going to go in a tanker and go to China or wherever, and it's going to be burned and go into the atmosphere and contribute to global warming in the same way as if it went down to Texas.
It's very valuable, and it'll find a market somewhere. Someone will burn it.
Yeah.
Because of growing global energy demand. How about fracking? How's fracking playing into the debate right now?
Well, fracking, I think the industry, and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think the industry may have felt just a little bit blindsided because other shales elsewhere in the country, in Oklahoma and Texas, have been fracked. The same process has gone on. Liquids pumped deep, deep underground, up to a mile underground, to disturb the rock, liquids and chemical compounds, to sort of disturb the rock and get the gas loose from where it's in very tight formations. That's gone on in Wyoming and the Jonah Field near Pinedale. That's gone on in Texas. That's gone on in Oklahoma. So, bingo, you come to the Marcellus Shale, which is sort of in the backyard of the East Coast megalopolis, and it becomes a major issue. And I think it's not too surprising that the natural gas industry was a little bit blindsided by that. That said, they've been not entirely forthcoming about what's in the chemical substance. Clearly, those of you who've seen the movie Gasland have seen water in people's kitchen sinks lit on fire. It's very, very effective television and very effective video. So that obviously some methane has leaked. Like the well in the Gulf, they didn't do a very good job of making sure that things that were supposed to be inside the pipe stayed inside the pipe. So that, again, is an awful lot of bad, things that are clearly not great for the environment. But are you going to weigh that against using the oil that we have, which is much worse in terms of greenhouse gas emissions?
Not to mention coal.
Yeah, thank you. Not to mention coal, or use natural gas as a transition fuel to a better day, which a lot of people make the argument for. So, again, I think fracking is getting a lot of play right now. It should. The gas companies should be, aware of what they're doing. But I think the larger context is sometimes missed.
And then I don't think the people in the Northeast are going to mind paying less to heat their homes in the winter, because the price of gas has totally plummeted. It was only in 2005, I recall, that there were plans to build at least a dozen liquefied natural gas regasification plants on the West Coast and on the Gulf Coast and on the East Coast, and bring the stuff in from Australia. And every one of those, except for maybe one, have gone belly up. And the enviros hated that, you know. So.
And now there's talk of the U.S. being an exporter of natural gas, whereas a few years ago we might have been an importer. It's knocking out nuclear, which some enviros like, but it's also knocking out renewables, which enviros don't like. It's very complicated, the gas gas story. Let's talk about what's driving some of this coverage. Are these stories that are out there that the news media are responding to politicians or things, or let's talk about what's really what's driving the narrative, the energy narrative.
Well, I mean, I think, again, the elephant in the room is climate change, and that has become...
And no one's talking about it.
I was going to say,
so,
that has become the subject that dare not speak its name, and therefore people are using other things to talk about. The two major subjects are the energy future and what does it mean for climate change, and how do we work those two out as a nation. And as with everything else in the country now, there's such division. The notion that you can't mention climate change in a Republican primary except to denigrate it. Again, just 5-6 years ago, I was at a hearing on Capitol Hill when Al Gore, his sort of first major public appearance, this was before An Inconvenient Truth, just before it, and it was his first major public appearance since the 2000 election, and maybe it was 7 years ago. And there was a bunch of House Republicans, some of them talking the way the people in the Republican primaries are talking now, but at least one, a Republican from Maryland, a kind of crusty old guy, said, just because I'm a Republican doesn't mean I'm a fool or an idiot. I mean, there was a time when it was okay for Republicans to acknowledge what the science seems to be saying on this, and this is not that time. So you have these two major issues, and I think, again, because the climate discussion isn't being engaged because it's become toxic, you have these auxiliary issues or proxies for it.
How about inside the editorial meetings, the newsrooms at the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times? I mean, do you shy away from climate stories because it's not on the table, because the politicians are not putting it on the table?
Well, being in Sacramento, I don't attend a lot of those.
Lucky.
But I mean the whole issue is the climate changing, is the earth warming. That went from being kind of mostly decided in the public place to being a political issue where people were still fighting about that basic question. That's what's happening now. We had President Bush and McCain. They all agreed that there was climate change. And now that's not under agreement, and there's all these conspiracy theories and such. But so I think in the papers, it's not organized how things wind up in the paper. It's a lot more random than the layman may think. I mean, first of all, reporters get ideas, or people call in, sources, documents. Bosses, supervisors hear something on NPR driving to work. There's all kinds of things like that. But there are still a lot of stories. Some of them are driven by the campaign, the presidential campaign, like we've just been talking about. But after you mentioned a survey that said that there was less coverage, I just looked back for the last 4 months to try and get up to speed in the LA Times archives, and there were stories to one degree or another about global warming, climate change, renewable energy, etc. Almost every day there was something, big or small. So I don't think that it's by a half dozen reporters on different beats in different parts of the paper. So I think it's getting covered. You just can't keep the waters are rising every day, but just in the Salchis Island, where I think it was last week,
the Maldives
Prime Minister,
Islands,
is it the Maldives?
Yeah, the president was ousted.
Yeah, he got overthrown, and he was all about, we're going to lose the islands, they're going to be underwater in no time, so... came up even in that context.
There's also recently been developments in the effort to kind of prosecute or go after climate scientists. You know, the Supreme Court in Virginia not long ago said no to the state attorney general who wanted to subpoena the emails and grant applications of Michael Mann, who is the scientist associated with the famous hockey stick graph. And so there are things happening that are kind of immediate stories that get covered in an immediate sense. But I'd also say, as for that that study that said the coverage was down, one, yes, if there's not an immediate electoral or legislative controversy, you don't get the sort of extra juice of the coverage from the legislative reporters, which, you know, goes into the whole total. But I have a colleague, Justin Gillis, who does enormously valuable takeouts on things like glacial ice or sea level rise or
permafrost.
Permafrost. Mm-hmm. Some of these, you know, what's happening in Greenland and what does it mean? These are magnificent pieces of work. They get into the nuance. The paper gives them a huge amount of space. Justin gets a great deal of time to work on them. It's all, you know, this is what I think newspapers should be doing in a period when the daily news isn't providing sparks for coverage. But each of those counts in this kind of survey as one article. Well,
yeah.
Okay, and they count the same as a blog post I might do in an hour.
So how it's measured, how it's counted matters. But would you agree that generally there were some peaks around an inconvenient truth, peaks around Copenhagen, and since that time there's been sort of a lowering of some coverage because it's not front and center in the political agenda, and because, as Mark said, you know, we've kind of covered that. Well, we've done sea level rise. Until it rises some more, okay, we've done...
But look at the Solyndra issue. Look how much coverage that generated.
Did it get too much?
No, I don't think it got too much. It was an interesting subject, and the subject of these federal supports for these projects is really interesting, and it's taxpayer money. But I did one story that noted, well, Solyndra was a big scandal. By the end of the year, California had approved, and the feds had approved, about $7 billion worth of these big solar projects out in the desert, and they were all kind of going through the process full steam ahead. Now they run into problems, environmental problems, lawsuits, et cetera, but financial, but they were all pushed out by Schwarzenegger and Brown in about 8 months in quite a remarkable show of... determination.
Right, with the Interior Department locked arm in arm with them.
Exactly,
to make sure
totally,
that they
yeah.
Get on federal
and,
lands.
And just, you know, on the fracking issue, the New York Times did some tremendous work, numerous long articles right literally in their backyard, which was quite impressive.
We're talking about media coverage and climate change with Mark Lifshur from the Los Angeles Times and Felicity Beringer from the New York Times. How has the shrinking newspaper industry affected coverage? Fewer people doing these stories? Has that been an impact at all? Mark Lifshur?
Yeah, I think that's impacted all papers. Now, the bigger the paper was to start with in terms of staff, the better it is to continue coverage. But we have fewer reporters who deal with various aspects of the environment than we used to. We used to have quite an army. Now we have a fairly large squad, you know, and there's plenty of people. But, you know, I've been at the Times since 2004, and we had about 1,000 editorial employees, and now we have about half that. So it does have an impact, especially when you get away from the 4 or 5 or 6 biggest papers, then you see a real fall off because they don't have the resources. But then again, they use stories from the New York Times, the LA Times, other big papers.
How about the New York Times?
Well, we've actually, within the last 3 years, we created an entirely separate group of reporters devoted to environmental and energy coverage. And so in that sense, we went up by, I think, one. All these people existed elsewhere in the paper, and they were put together. But we now have an editor who only works on these issues, and she has a deputy. So I would say we've kind of regularized coverage in a way across the paper. because most things flow through this. It doesn't mean people who aren't environment reporters on their business card don't do environmental stories, but it's a way to sort of look at the issues through, you know, through one lens and coordinate things throughout the paper. But I think Mark's right. Overall, while the Times may have, you know, kind of set aside a dedicated staff for this and have a dedicated editor for it, you're seeing less, not just less reporters in papers across the country, but less space. And that's true of the Times, too. Our, you know, much to the reporters' consternation, a few years ago, there was a space limit put on all page one stories that are not major projects. It's been adhered to mostly since then. I have a piece out waiting that is maybe a little above the space limit, but that's okay. Every word is a gem. But at the same time as that's been happening, you have the Internet and you have blogs. And we have two blogs. My colleague, former colleague Andy Revkin, who's now at Pace University, is still associated with a paper and runs a blog called .earth. And there's a blog that I contribute to called Green, which takes in all these issues. And that's where some of the slack gets taken up. And you have a dedicated audience for those.
And things that didn't exist or I barely heard of a few years ago, Grist and all sorts of GigaOM, and there's some very specialty things. Yeah. So it becomes perhaps more fragmented and specialized. What are some of the sources you look to out there outside your own organizations that you respect, you think are doing a good job covering these issues?
You mean in terms of journalism?
Yeah.
Well, the New York Times and The Economist and...
Of the sort of non-traditional paper, you know, print-based organizations that are more web-based, blogs, et cetera, that you...
Well, I mean, I look at the Internet all the time, and I usually don't go to distinct environmental websites, but the stuff floats out in various forms.
In traditional in that it's on paper, but non-traditional in its style. High Country News is terrific on these issues, and I check in with Grist regularly. But there's a whole host of other things, as you say, GigaOM. I've become a convert to Twitter because it's a little bit like a wire service feeding you things. If you are following interesting people and they are posting, you can get an advance warning.
Very useful tool for reporters. You mentioned the campaign against some scientists recently, which is going on. It may have been pushed back in Virginia, but there's still scientists are being harassed, they would say, by Freedom of Information Act. Does that ever affect journalism? Do the skeptics or deniers ever have a chilling effect? Well, if I write this, I know I'm going to get flamed and get lots of hate mail.
Well, there's always a delete button. You do get hate mail, and you do get insulting and very personally insulting hate mail, and I just delete them.
Put it this way, whatever hate mail Mark and I may get, or other environmental reporters, it's not a patch on what the reporters covering Israel get. So, it does rather go with the territory as a reporter. But
it comes with the territory.
Yeah. The other thing I would say, just in terms of reaction, it's sort of a discipline. If you know that somebody's going to come after you, first, on space, you've got to cut down on words. So you say, you know, sea level is expected to rise by such and such an amount. But you can hear on your shoulder somebody who's emailed you before from an angry, skeptical point of view saying, expected. You don't give any sources. So I will go and get the studies, or one study in particular, and I'll link it to the word expected. Doesn't help the readers of the print paper much, but it does help the people who are reading online, which is where a lot of the commentary comes in. You go, okay, right. If you don't like me saying it's expected, here's the scientist who says why it's expected at some length.
But you're a non-scientist trying to evaluate the credibility of science. That gets pretty complicated, right? I mean, do you read the peer review articles and say, okay, this is...
Everybody's got a backstop. My backstop is the peer reviewers. Yes, I recently had a post that came off two peer-reviewed articles that were out simultaneously in Geophysical Research Letters. There are probably, 15 or so really good journals. Well, it's like going to the Los Angeles Times or my own newspaper, whatever. you have an expectation that what's in these journals has been edited and has been looked at properly. So given that expectation, it's not a problem to read. And then my cut is, can I understand it? Or do I think if I can't understand it, do I think there's enough probability that it's interesting to call the scientists and say, what exactly did you mean here?
And is there what's called sort of a balance bias? Sometimes people say the media have a bias to, well, that there's a consensus on climate science. They have to present that, well, not everyone agrees with that consensus. How do papers deal with that?
Well,
what is the debate over?
It's basic journalism. We have to try and put the other side. If the other side is totally nonsensical and irrational, we may not include that, but there's always, you know, someone who will express skepticism or have some thoughtful views. I mean, we have to put that in. The thing is,
even if 97 scientists say we agree on certain,
well,
premise,
it's
three,
not out of balance.
We don't
measure it, but you can mention the context that there's controversy in politics, that it's driving parts of the campaign, that candidates say this and say that. What you have to remember is we're journalists, we're lay people. We may have developed some scintilla of expertise, but we're not scientists and we're not judges and we don't come down with rulings. We do the best job we can to gather the information in an impartial and not passionate, but still interesting manner, and we give it our best shot. And then it's edited by editors who can hopefully improve and make it more fair and more readable. And then it goes out there. And if some people don't like it, then you know, what are you going to do? You
it's
know,
freaking, yeah, sure.
I mean, maybe the next article they'll like it better. You know,
Felicity Beringer.
I mean, I think the first sort of accusations of what's now widely known as false balance, where, as you say, 99 people say something or 97 people say something, but you've got to balance it with the other three. I think we're well past that. But I've had accusations of false balance, and I know that one of my colleagues, Elizabeth Rosenthal, was excoriated for writing in some depth about the fact of and the impact of the emails that were stolen from the University of East Anglia. And they, you know, used some epithets about climate skeptics, and they generally acted like, you know, the language was something that if you disagreed with the issue, you would fix on this language as saying these are a bunch of insiders doing things. Well, let's say, for argument's sake, that all of the East Anglia stuff was a sideshow and the journalists shouldn't have spent much attention with it. It's the era of the Internet. That stuff was being covered like gangbusters.
And covered as ClimateGate. Some
yeah,
people might
yeah,
know
yeah,
it better.
Yeah, exactly. Gate. Thank you. Covered as ClimateGate. It's not a
East Anglia. Yeah.
It's not a word that I tend to go with, so I was avoiding it. But that's absolutely right. It comes by the name of ClimateGate. Well, okay, let's say 2 years down the road you get the election, or 3 years down the road you get the election we have now, in which there's all this, you know, sort of acceptance of the idea that the scientists are somehow corrupt or something. If no journalist from the mainstream media had covered what's known as ClimateGate, our readers would have a very good point if they asked us, where did this come from? How come you didn't tell us people were thinking this way? We report on what's going on around us. If we report on someone who denies that climate change is real, that doesn't mean we're accepting that. Right. That means we're telling our readers, look, there are people out here who think this way. Again, at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, I know there was some talk in newspapers that we had been totally out of touch, and the militia movement caught us by surprise. It therefore caught our readers by surprise. Well, we kind of think our readers shouldn't be surprised, so we're going to cover what's happening. And if people want to call it false balance, be my guest.
And, you know, the enviros can share some of those same attributes. I remember some time ago, it wasn't a very big story, but I was offered an exclusive on a study that said California was way ahead in rooftop solar. We were putting more rooftop solar up than we thought we would, and it was a real breakthrough. And at the same time, some other environmental group offered me another study, and they had some economists that environmentalists didn't like who said, yeah, you know, solar's good and renewables are great. We should do them. But, you know, there's a lot of oil in California and there's a lot of natural gas onshore, not even offshore. And we ought to be getting that, too, and using them all. And afterwards, the enviros were very upset with me. And I said, well, you know, I got two studies, so I threw them both out, you know.
Each side wants you to sort of see it their way, write about it their way, you know, write their narrative.
Yeah.
We're talking about climate and media coverage.
Keep in mind that the relationship between reporters and their sources, no matter who they are, whether they're enviros, they're oil companies, or everyone else in every other beat, they're very symbiotic and they can be very manipulative. And so everyone, it's a marketplace, and everyone's sort of looking for something, and the reporter tries to balance it out, but it's
sources
still
are
transactional.
Trying to use you to achieve an end.
Totally, yeah, which is fine.
That's yeah, I was going to say,
you know
that's
that.
I mean, we talked about it not long ago.
We're talking about media and climate change with Felicity Beringer from the New York Times and Mark Lifshur from the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Dalton. We mentioned the ClimateGate scandal. One companion story recently was Peter Glick is an environmentalist who admitted recently that he did something similar and under false pretenses obtained some information from an institute that's part of the climate skeptic camp. Let's talk about that one, Felicity.
It was sort of bizarre for those of us who know and have worked with Peter Glick. It was when a colleague told me about it, I did use the phrase, I'm gobsmacked. I just could not. It didn't compute for me.
He's one of the most authoritative water experts in the world.
I write a lot about water, and he is an expert on a global scale. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant some couple of decades ago. He founded the Pacific Institute. It's based in Oakland. It does, you know, groundbreaking work on water. Not so much original research, although some of that, but collating what's out there and getting it out in accessible form. This is invaluable service since water and freshwater access issues are only going to get more complicated with climate change. So he takes, he says, a letter in the mail that has a document from a group in Chicago called the Heartland Institute. And the Heartland Institute memo talks about a program to get skeptic education in grades K through 12. And it talks about other things, including that it has some very provocative language like we want it, something, I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but we maybe this will help science teachers stop teaching or something along those lines that any reporter would pull out and quote immediately. So he says he was looking for a way to verify this, and he posed as a board member of the Heartland Institute, set up an email account, and called them and said, use this account to send me stuff, and then requested specific stuff over time, and then sent it out to a couple of blogs and that made it all public, including the memo that Heartland says was a fake.
And this is a person who was head of a scientific ethics group at the American Geophysical Union?
He was. He resigned that group the day before. Oh, no, he resigned that group about 4 days before he copped to having posed as somebody else. He obtained the stuff under false pretenses.
And now what's the impact? What's the fallout? Mark Lifshur, anything in terms of his credibility or the...
Well, yeah.
How's this being used as
well? He's going to be damaged goods, you know. If we did something like that, we'd be fired immediately. He's damaged goods, which is too bad. That's sort of a human foible. But the interesting thing is, if you think global warming and climate is controversial, it's nothing compared to water. I mean, water in California for more than 100 years has been the most controversial subject that exists. I mean, people, you know, they kill over water all the time.
And it's a major exception to what Mark said earlier about California being in the forefront on a lot of environmental things. California has been one of the last states in the union to even think about asking farmers to anybody who's got a well on the ground to record how much they're pumping. It's, you know, until 3 years ago or less, it was anathema. You couldn't even ask the whole agricultural industry to say how much groundwater they were pumping. Even while on the west side of the Central Valley, you have some of the greatest subsidence anywhere in the country as a result of decades of overpumping.
Yeah. And salt all over.
So California, which likes to pride itself on its environmental and clean energy leadership, is a water laggard.
Well, I mean, the problem here is we've got this giant state with 38 million people. At least two-thirds of it is basically in the middle of an arid zone to a complete desert. And all the most of the water comes from the north and has to go to the south. So you have you have the world's largest, most productive farming industry in the world and tons of people. And people from the north up here get totally upset that the south is stealing their water. And, you know, it's an old saw, you know, that Mark Twain said that, you know, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting or something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and that's going to get, if the scientists are right, I think I read recently that the Sierra snowpack this year is about 25% of normal. If the scientists are right, water stress in California is going to be more severe.
I don't think what's happened this year, it's just 1 year. I don't think the reservoirs are still pretty much full from last year.
Yeah, remember how much rain there was last
year.
So 1 year doesn't make a trend, but if the Sierra snowpack is declining over the last 10, 20 years or so, it's volatile year to year, but there's a slow, gradual trend. I mean, you cover water a lot. Do you think water stress is going to be a key climate story?
Water stress is a climate story. I mean, there are water managers in the country who can't, for reasons of the states that they work in, you know, can't really talk about climate change. So I asked one of them, what do you say? And he says, drought. This is, you know, wherever, I think you'll find the people who manage water on the east side of the state probably don't vote Democratic very often, but all of them will talk about the fact that there is gradually less snowpack. Certainly the melt comes earlier. The system, the entire plumbing system of the state that supports this $30 billion agricultural economy, it was created for a different time. And just as, you know, I hate to say it, but just as you grow older, your shoes don't fit quite as well and you suddenly change shoe sizes and stuff, this state has to change its plumbing configuration. And California's not alone. A lot of states will have to do this. The Colorado River's bounty has been going down.
Which
and
that's comes here as well.
Yeah, which that's yeah. also supplies Southern California. So, yes, I wanted to cover water in part because at a point when climate change becomes a kind of religious discussion and some of the rationality leeches out of it, water is never a religious discussion, but it is often a very contentious one.
One thing I did learn in the one time I worked for an East Coast newspaper and wrote about water out here is the editors sit in their windows and they look out at the Hudson and they say, what problem with water? I mean, they look out and they see that New Yorker famous cover, and you talk about water, and they just give you a complete blank stare, you know.
Mark Lifshitz is a reporter for the New York Times. We're also talking about climate change in the media with Felicity Beringer of the New York Times. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about some positive stories. One of the positive stories in California, clean energy-wise, has been solar, a lot of deployment of solar. Which one of you would like to talk a little bit about that? But California is also losing its lead in solar as some of the other states are gaining market share. Mark?
Well, just to quickly just kind of go off track for a second. I think the biggest success in California is energy efficiency. The State Public Utilities Commission has a thing called a loading order, which sets their priorities for how they will supply electricity to the state. The first one, number one, is efficiency, because every electron of electricity that you save is one you don't have to make with whether it's a solar investment or gas or coal or whatnot. And the state has, it's led the world in that. It's We've saved so much electricity in 30 years that it's probably the equivalent of, 25 or 30 basic power plants. On solar, it's a slow, difficult process, but I think they're starting to make some headway. There's a lot of approvals for these big desert solar centralized plants, but they have a rough road ahead of them. Even after they've been fast-tracked by the feds and the state, there's all kinds of environmental pitfalls, financing pitfalls, economic pitfalls, getting the capital.
Transmission.
And transmission, yeah. I mean, these places are out in the desert, and no one wants a power line near their house or in a beautiful vista, desert vista, and there's no other way. How do you get the electricity from there? So it's a very difficult process.
I think one of the things that has surprised me somewhat, both back east in the reporting I've done on alternative energy there and here, is the fact that no matter how environmentally better, how much a particular power source is going to reduce carbon emissions, reduce air particulates, reduce all the things that come with conventional power plants, there's going to be somebody who doesn't want it wherever it's going to be placed. That's why I used the word siting, which is, almost a dirty, not a dirty word, but a scary word among anybody who's interested in energy, because there's two kinds of, three kinds of people. The people who can rationally deal with this and accommodate it close to them, the people who you all know the acronym NIMBYs, not in my backyard, and the newer acronym, which I've learned, which is BANANA. Don't build anything near any place. it goes on like that. I can't do it.
Nothing
all.
Nowhere. Yeah.
Exactly. Nothing nowhere. And also John Leschi, who used to be Solicitor General at the Interior Department, said in an article I once covered and have repeated several times, there is no square yard of earth in the United States that somebody doesn't love. So that's what's happening with these large-scale solar plants. They take up an awful lot of space, they're in deserts, and they're things like the desert tortoise. And, so you have a national branch of an environmental group like the Sierra Club saying, we want solar, we want wind. And you have the local branch of the Sierra Club saying, don't hurt the desert tortoise. And it's, it really does become a problem. But California's got more rooftop solar, still not nearly enough, but it has just under half the national share of rooftop solar as of 2010. That's down as a proportion from two-thirds in 2008, but as a whole, it's all going up. And states like New Jersey, with a Republican governor, New Jersey has made incredible strides in this area. So, as Mark said earlier, with the exception of water, California really does provide, it sort of lead the way. And I'm sort of surprised that some of the other southwestern states are, rank a whole lot lower than New Jersey.
And some of the solar stuff, a lot of these big projects, they will be built because we absolutely need them, and California has a law that requires that one-third of all the electricity, both from the investor-owned utilities and the municipal-owned utilities like L.A. Department of Power and Water, is going to have to come from renewable sources by 2020. So, and the utilities are out signing contracts left and right, and Either they're going to have to declare failure or something's got to give.
Although they do get a little bit of leeway from the state on missing their targets by a year.
They got
or two.
Leeway on the 2010
mandate, but not the later.
Well,
ones.
We don't know. Let's wait till we get a little closer.
We are going to put a microphone up here, invite your participation. And again, if you're on this side of the audience, please go through that door. And the line starts with Jane Ann, our producer back there. And welcome your one-part question. If you need help keeping it short, I'll be happy to help you. We'll get going here in a minute. While that's getting sorted, I'll just ask one more question. Later this year, California is going to start its own cap-and-trade program. Nothing's happening
with the United States nationally. Several states have pulled back. Where is this going to go? What kind of impact is this going to have? California going ahead on cap and trade. Felicity Barrier?
Okay. Well, I think, again, when the law was passed and signed by Governor Schwarzenegger in 2006, almost everybody envisioned it as the first step to a national program, and it would eventually become subsumed in the national program. Well, that was then. Now, I think it's in some ways like I always worry about doing analogies on the fly, but I'd say a little bit like the monks in the Middle Ages who kept copying the manuscripts from the classical era to show, you know, to keep the knowledge alive. It shows that it can be done. It'll have some flaws. That'll give a sort of warning post. It's a trial, I think, and the fact that there is now an active ability to trade between California emissions certificates when they become real next year, and Quebec, and that there are two or three other Canadian provinces lined up, shows that this can go beyond a single state. But is it going to have a major effect on greenhouse gases? Not really.
I mean, even in theory, as it's planned in the regulations by the ARB, if it works, it'll provide maybe a fifth of the progress towards meeting the AB 32 goal. There could be a lot of lawsuits. There, you know, manufacturers are going to claim that, depending on how the money from the auctions, from the sale of these things, how it's used, it could run afoul of Prop 13 and subsequent initiatives. And I know the Manufacturers Association is thinking about the legal implications, and there could be lawsuits.
Let's go to our first audience question here for Felicity Barringer and Mark Lifshire. Yes.
Well, it's Ethan Ravitch with the International Emissions Trading Association. Eric Cantor over in with the IHT in Europe covers us fairly substantially with the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme. Yes, you brought out a lot of issues with what's going to happen in California with its linkages to the trading schemes up in Quebec. The other three, I believe, are Manitoba, British Columbia, and not Saskatchewan, but there's
and
one
Ontario,
other.
Right?
Yeah, Ontario. Yeah, and so. Where did the dialogue go off track, do you think? If you look back to about 2007, 2008, there were no fewer than about 7 or 8 different Senate bills in the U.S. We actually had a recognition of the problem, and now, as you said, it's become more of a religiosity issue. Are we actually, instead of it being a solved issue, it's a political issue. Yeah. But nonetheless, there's a lot that can be done to communicate, again, that things like markets can be used to help bring a lot of divergent groups together to create new investments and get us on a track towards a greener future.
So your question is, where did it get off track?
Where did it get off track?
Well, there's a political aspect which we're seeing unfold in the campaign, which is really off track. And then there's economic issues that have always been around prior to AB 32 and in the debate that led to its passage and after. The fact is that manufacturers in California feel that they've been very oppressed for a long time. And manufacturing, they'll tell you it's a lot worse than it is, but a lot of manufacturing has fled to other states and overseas. And they're already paying some of the highest electric rates in the country, and they fear simply that cap and trade and renewables will drive those costs even higher. And it's as simple as that.
So some politics and the 2008 recession were part of what took it
out. Yeah, no, I think the recession is a key thing to mention. But, where things went off track, there was the recession, there was ClimateGate. But those who oppose cap and trade most fiercely tend to oppose all regulation. You've heard the EPA demonized, and I occasionally want to ask people, do you want the Cuyahoga River to burn all over again? I mean, the EPA, do we want Los Angeles, where you can now actually see the San Gabriel Mountains, a good number of days a year as opposed to 1 week? Do we really want to go back to that? I don't think so, but they tied, it was successfully tied cap and trade to regulation. And frankly, the idea was that energy prices were supposed to go up if you emitted carbon. Therefore, there was a certain amount of truth to the notion that energy, or to the fear that energy prices might go up. Couple that with the recession and the sort of atavistic objection to government regulation, you put them all together, and I think it's a pretty toxic mix.
But it was also, cap and trade was a Republican idea, market-based, of the options. It was the more market-friendly option, and it was killed by the proponents of free markets.
Well, because they moved. You know, I mean, let's face it, Richard Nixon could never get elected dog catcher now. And, you know, and he created all this stuff, the EPA and lots of these environmental laws. It was all Nixon, you know. And, you know, he would be seen as a complete big government oppressor right now.
A rhino, they would call him, Republican in name only these days. Mark Lifshire is a reporter with the New York Times. We're also talking with Felicity Beringer from the New York Times. Let's have our next audience question.
Many of the mainstream media articles about electric cars seem to be very negative and often are inaccurate. Do you think that will change when reporters and editors actually drive electric cars themselves?
Well, I'll take a quick flyer at that. I am not giving up my current Subaru Forester, which I love, but I have committed to getting a plug-in hybrid for my next car. I don't quite know where I'm going, but I'm thinking of a Prius. So that's for this reporter. But I'm not sure that the coverage has been as negative as you say. I'll let Mark speak to that.
Well, if you look at, I don't think it's been negative in our paper. First of all, the hybrids we have now have been well received, and I'm sure lots of journalists as well as lots of just regular people drive them. And the new cars that are coming to market seem to be, they're getting fairly good reviews. I haven't seen that. You know, some people are concerned. There are a lot of problems that have to be worked out with electric cars, the distance that they can travel and charging them up. And if you don't have a garage, you know, how are you gonna charge it up? Gonna have a wire coming out of your house and going out to the streets, you know. But they're coming, that's for sure.
I'm not a reporter, but I do own an electric car, and I love it, the Nissan Leaf. It's fast, it's zippy, it's clean. No, not for that, but just that they are out there. And I'll give either of you a ride anytime within 50 miles so I can get back home. There is that. It is a little odd to go to say to a friend in Menlo Park, I'd like to come over for dinner, and I'd like to eat, and I also like to plug into your wall outlet so I can get some electricity, or otherwise I'll never leave. I can't get home. Let's have our next audience question.
Gary Latchell. I'll describe myself as a retired physicist. What I feel is underreported is the global warming potential of a lot of these things, particularly the Keystone pipe, because the sandstone takes a lot of energy to extract, and even the fracking and the natural gas, because natural gas leakage can more than offset its advantages over coal.
So life cycle analysis.
Yeah, I think the life cycle analysis, you raise an excellent point. I talked about gas leaking from, which is where Gasland gets its pictures of sinks going on fire, sinks full of water, or taps going on fire. But I think life cycle analysis is going to be kind of crucial to really looking at what is the benefit or cost of a fuel. I do think that it's in the natural gas industry's interest to stop the leakage. They can then sell what doesn't leak. But yes, the methane, which is natural gas, is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and that is a really significant issue, leakage.
And the life cycle of tar sands?
Well, I mean, they use a lot of energy. I mean, I used to work in Venezuela, and they have a oil down by the Orinoco River, which is the consistency of asphalt, and they didn't use it for years and years and years, but then American and foreign oil companies came and they found a way to crack it so it could be made into light sweet crude, and they actually now have bigger reserves in Venezuela than Saudi Arabia, so that's a pretty hard thing with all your life cycle, it's pretty hard to make the argument that it shouldn't be used. You know, someone's going to want to commercialize that.
There's a lot of energy demand out there. Yes, sir, and that's the audience question.
Yes, my name is Angelo Festa. I'm a San Francisco resident. I drove a Prius for 11 years. And even with the gas savings, I got sick and tired of shelling out $50 to fill it up. So I became a Leaf owner a year ago. I haven't seen a gas station in a year, and I don't care what the price of gas is.
Yeah, right.
I have solar collectors on my roof. So essentially, I'm taking the sun's energy and putting it into my car.
Now, do you want to buy one for them or no?
I give you a ride just like he offered.
Okay.
But here's something that really irks me. Within the last 10 days, a major breakthrough has hit the news on the Internet, but I couldn't find it in the newspapers. Stop me if I'm wrong. And here's what happened. A small company over in Newark came up with a battery system that delivers 10 times the energy density of what we have now in our Leafs. So think of it. Bottom line is you'll be able to drive your Leaf or Coda or whatever electric car you have 10 times further.
But it didn't get coverage. I saw the story in the San Jose Mercury News. I don't know about the Times, either of the Times.
I haven't seen it.
I would just caution you, there are a lot of developments on small scale that can't be built out on a large scale. And it's great. Look, if they can do this, if they honestly can get 6 times, 8 times, 10 times the density and not have it burn up and not have it weigh so much that you can't get go over 35 or whatever. I think there are 8 different parameters that batteries are measured on, and obviously energy density is a crucial one, but it's not the only one, and gaining on energy density may lose you on some of the other parameters. So what I'd be interested in is not so much have they built it in one factory or have they built 10 batteries, but is this something that can be built out to scale? Now, question of when you cover something, as Mark said at the beginning, is a little idiosyncratic. That doesn't mean necessarily it shouldn't be covered, but I would be a little cautious. That's all, Mark. You cover this area more than I do.
Yeah, well, I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
So,
but there's lots of promising technology, some of which makes it to market and scale, and a lot of it sort of
fails. Which does bring me to one point. And sir, you were talking about Newark, California. Is that right?
Yeah, it was
Newark,
here in the Bay Area.
California. Well, I brought a clip down that was in our paper, and earlier this year it was reported that like 40% of all the venture capital in the United States that went to energy or global warming or anything along those lines came to California. So it's showing up at companies like that and small companies all around Northern California, I imagine, principally. And, this is the laboratory of the world. So when you hear about all these jobs going overseas and et cetera, there's a lot of them are being replaced by really important work here in California.
Let's have our next audience question.
Hi, Mark and Felicity and Greg. Thank you for being here and thank you for all of your great work. Lori Sinsley with Environmental Defense Fund. Going back to your comments about how the media is covering climate change, the toxic term, whatever it is these days, I think that there is a really important part for the media to play educating the public, and I think that the balance is something that confuses them. They're like, well, so-and-so said this, and they don't know what to believe. I think the majority of Americans don't, so I just kind of want to point that out. And I'm not saying we, of course, love your papers, but what role do you see the media playing in, like, pointing out how extreme weather events and, you know, Americans sort of, like, increasing belief that the climate is changing? How is that going to affect your media coverage?
You know, what we do is not so mysterious or intellectual. We're journalists, and we're basically charged with getting good stories that people are going to read all the way to the end or close to that. and they'll turn it to their wife, and it's a cliche, and say, "Hey, Martha, did you see this?" That's what we do. We're not. So when there are good stories, we go out and we tell them to the best of our ability. And if it's about the environment, we're looking for something new, something that is hasn't come out before, something that's maybe contradictory to the established line of thought, and something that people read and will make our bosses happy and get a lot of hits on the internet and hopefully keep from selling fewer and fewer newspapers. So we're just looking for good stories, and if it's sometimes they're about the environment and various aspects of that, and then there are about other things as well.
And the other thing is, for better or worse, I think our environmental coverage needs to be science-based. And sadly, there was a, there was a study in a recent issue of Geophysical Research Letters, one of the journals I go to, saying that it's not going to be, to be able to say this weather event is worse because of climate change, it's, the article said temperatures will have to rise about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit from where they were in the early 20th century before you can tease out of the sort of noise and background variability in weather events an actual relation to climate change. So the impact is going to be visible before us long before scientists will be able to say with certitude that was climate change that did that.
That's pretty interesting. The, we're getting toward the end here. Let's have our last audience question. Yes, sir.
You've kind of talked about the current situation, politically toxic and so forth. And so my question is, as observers of society, what do you think is going to potentially change the track that we're on, perhaps move us more towards a consensus? Are we talking some sort of visible environmental catastrophe? Are we talking a change in our economic situation and the return of the good times, or something? You know, I'm just curious as to what you think might inflect the current path we're on and move towards perhaps a more consensus situation.
I think on strictly in the California level, there have been two big changes that most people aren't aware of. They're kind of technical that will make a difference. One is that the voters a couple years ago ordered up that the drawing of the lines of redistricting for legislative and congressional seats should be done by an independent citizens panel. And in fact, this is the first time it's been done, and it'll be in effect in November. What that's going to do is, in the past, the legislature itself has always gerrymandered the state, creating a majority of safe seats for Democrats because there are more Democrats, but a minority of equally safe seats for Republicans. So what you got is the most liberal Democrats in most of the Democratic seats and the most conservative Republicans in the Republican seats. And because the state until recently needed a two-thirds vote to pass the budget, and you still need a two-thirds vote to raise taxes, it created a hardening of all the positions in a gridlock. Now that is going to change after the election in November. The other thing is we've gone to a primary system that instead of the highest number of votes for the Democrat and the highest number of votes for the Republican, we've got the top two, no matter what party they be in. So the idea is, and I think it will happen, is it'll push the eventual office holders from the extremes to the middle. And it'll happen on the state level, but also we have a, I think, 53-person congressional or 52-person congressional delegation. It will have that effect there. And I think those are very, very, very relatively unsung positive changes happening in California.
Felicity Beringer, the last word?
I would just add briefly, I'm afraid you're right. I think we can't underestimate the impact of Katrina on people's thinking about climate change in the 2006-07 period. Katrina was 2005, and, you know, big weather events get people's attention, and that's, you know, the nature of who we are. The threat has to kind of be in front of us and visible before we really respond.
One big weather event last year was that Snowtober hit the media editors, having formerly been one of them on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I think after it hit home, literally, for some of the media people in New York, you started to see some more stories, ABC News in particular, pretty good stories on whether that can be attributed to climate change or not. It woke some people up. That's all the time we have. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank Mark Lifshitz with the New York Times.
LA Times.
Mark Lifshitz with the... We're not doing job trading here. Mark Lifshitz with the Los Angeles Times and Felicity Beringer with the New York Times. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.